Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Organized labor, trade policy, and pizza, in that order. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 26th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Organized labor was on the docket at the Supreme Court of the United States today. A case called Janus v. AFSCME, which is the Association of Federal, State, County, and Municipal Employees. Also, and not for nothing here, the biggest public employees union in this country. At issue is whether public sector unions, as they're known, they represent cops and teachers and all kinds of other government workers, whether they can charge what are called fair share fees to workers who aren't dues-paying members of the union. The deal here, not to get all jurisprudential on you, is that since government workers are all part of the same collective bargaining units, they can all get the same benefits without paying union dues, hence the unions charging those fair share fees. Anyway, an Illinois state worker named Mark Janus says those fees violate his First Amendment rights. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports his case is going to have implications far beyond the workplace.
More than 34% of government workers are represented by a union, compared to only 6.5% in the private sector.
Public sector unions are the growth engine of the labor movement now.
Gary Chasen is professor emeritus of industrial relations at Clark University. He says unions generally face less opposition from governments than from private employers. And as membership has declined overall, public unions make up a larger share of organized labor. If the Supreme Court blocks the fair share fees those unions charge non-members, that could change. Celine McNicholas with the Economic Policy Institute says workers might ask,
why am I, you know, paying for this when the person next to me is not contributing her fair share?
Ken Jacobs chairs the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. He says labor's political power is also at stake.
Unions have been the largest counterbalance in American politics to big corporations and the wealthy. They're the ones behind laws like higher minimum wage and paid sick days. So this could have a big effect not just on unions, but on all Americans.
Union membership has declined in states like Michigan after fair share fees were prohibited. But Daniel DeSalvo with the Manhattan Institute says there's another possible scenario.
They do lose some members and money, but the members that they retain are more dedicated to the union.
Even as private sector unions have lost members, DeSalvo says they've stayed relevant in politics by spending more of their budgets on political action. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's a big trade meeting on the agenda in Washington this week. Chinese President Xi's top trade person is coming to meet with his White House counterpart as the Trump administration tries to make good on its campaign promise to toughen up on its dealings with Beijing. The administration says national security concerns would justify tariffs or quotas on imported steel and aluminum. That's the proximate cause of this meeting. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson connects the economic dots here.
This starts with a simple economic problem, at least simple to understand, if not solve. Globally, the supply of steel and aluminum has grown much faster than demand. When supply exceeds demand, prices fall. Ishwar Prasad is a trade policy professor at Cornell.
A lot of the increase in the capacity has come from China. In China, of course, the government does play a significant role in propping up industries.
So the national security theory here is that if U.S. domestic steel and aluminum industries atrophy because they can't compete with low foreign prices, well, then we might not be able to make the things we need to defend ourselves. The Commerce Department recently offered a few options. Levy tariffs on all imports of steel and aluminum, target just a few countries, and or cap imports of both metals. Dan Eikenson with the Cato Institute.
I hope that they choose to do none of these because it really will inspire retaliation from other countries. I think this opens a Pandora's box and will encourage countries like China to do something similar on semiconductors, India to do something similar on food.
And domestically, higher tariffs could mean higher prices on stuff made from those metals. Emily Blanchard is a professor at Dartmouth.
Everything from tanks to airplanes to cars.
Even beer cans.
I am telling you, your beer could get more expensive.
More importantly, these options could put us in a tricky spot with important trading partners and allies, because lots of these imports actually come from Canada and Europe. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Also likely to be in that meeting with the Chinese this week, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. We are going to have the secretary on this program tomorrow talking trade and the tax law and all kinds of things. On Wall Street today, the major indices are at or within shouting distance of where they were before the recent troubles. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's take Tracy's story about America's trading relationships and riff on it here for a minute. Specifically, pull back a little bit and explore what happens if the Trump administration does continue its recent trend of pulling this country back from global engagement. Adam Posen is the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, writing recently on exactly that topic. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Headline on this piece is the post-American world economy. I wonder, based on my reading of your piece, whether we're not already there.
We're halfway there. The world is already anticipating some of the things the Trump administration is going to do, Kai. But also, there's been a lot of U.S. withdrawal in a soft way for several years already. So the world is already adapting. But they would rather have a continuing U.S. world economy if they could.
Why would they rather have that? I mean, I get that, you know, why it's in some people's interest in this country to be doing that. Why does the rest of the world want and or need that?
The U.S. doesn't always do the right thing, but on average, it both tries to do the right thing and professes to do the right thing more credibly than anybody else. A world where the enforcer of rules or the setting out of ideal behavior is Europe or China is just simply not going to be as trusted. The U.S. is the biggest country on the block, but it generally hasn't been the bully. It's been saying we should do commerce without bilateral pressure determining how that works. And it's worked out really well. The world's gotten much richer over the last 50 years, 60 years as a result of that.
With the acknowledgement that not everybody will agree with what you say, let me pick up on something that you did mention back there, and that is the word trust. I wonder in 3 or 7 years from now, when somebody else is in the White House and possibly there's an attempt to reengage the global economy, where does trust come into that equation?
It's a really good question to think about. The system that the U.S. built with the buy-in from Europe, Japan, and others is not just about trust. It is about a set of rules. It is about a set of institutions. So to some degree, it can survive as long as the U.S. doesn't directly attack those, as long as the U.S. pays its membership dues and lets itself be adjudicated by them. It doesn't have to lead them. But I think there's a good historical analogy to the late 70s. There was a huge amount of distrust of the U.S. after the U.S. broke the gold standard, ran irresponsible fiscal policies, fought the war in Vietnam, and it took several years for the U.S. to come back into people's trust. But eventually, they did.
I confess I have your article up on the computer screen in front of me here in the studio, and it occurs to me literally just now as I sit here and I talk to you, nowhere in the title or the subtitle, The Post-American World Economy, Globalization in the Trump Era, nowhere is the word trade mentioned.
Yeah. In fact, ironically, even though trade is probably the most hot topic, particularly under the Trump administration, but also it's just so visible and visceral, it's actually probably one of the most resilient parts of the global economy. Some of these other things are really important, including the role of the dollar, including foreign aid for developing countries, including crisis management, that are more vulnerable than trade.
Huh. One of the things that's been happening in this economy over the past number of decades, as globalization has taken effect and as jobs have been replaced by automation and any one of a number of things, is that the middle class and the working class in America have lost economic traction. And to paraphrase the president from the campaign, and I get that this is slightly a loaded comparison, but what have we got to lose if we try it a different way?
a lot. There's no question that wages have stagnated for a huge section of American workers, but nothing that we're talking about trying in another way affects that. It's like with NAFTA. I mean, the idea is not so much that we didn't go through pain and adjustment to have NAFTA, but we got something for it. We got more stability below the border. We got cheaper goods. We got more competitive in a good way in terms of pressure on our business to behave well and to produce well. And so if you take away NAFTA, for example, you go through all the misery of churn and jobs going away and people having to adjust in the hundreds of thousands and millions, but you get nothing for it. So the churn comes either way, but you want to get something when you put people through it. And that's part of what American globalization has done, is it's gotten us a lot.
Are you surprised at the speed with which, as you say, the post-American world economy has been arrived at? I mean, it's been 13 months since the inauguration, 14.
I'm not surprised because I think we're only partway there. And I'm not surprised because even under Obama, there was an extended period of the U.S., partly due to Congress and due to bad feeling in the lot of the voters, of withdrawal. But I do think if the Trump administration does go more forcibly down the road that they've been threatening going down of U.S. alone, U.S. as just a business competitor, everyone's going to be surprised by the speed with which this turns. Europe and China in particular, they're showing forbearance for the time being. They're like, okay, we want to see if the U.S. gets its act together. But once it becomes credible that the U.S. isn't doing that, things will happen very fast.
Adam Posen is the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He writes most recently in the forthcoming edition of Foreign Affairs about the post-American world economy. Globalization in the Trump era is the subtitle. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
This year, if you can believe it, is the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis really starting to squeeze this economy. Our project about those 10 years and how they changed this country is called Divided Decade, because it's not just our institutions that changed, the Fed and the big banks, I mean, but also we changed in our day-to-day lives and how we think about our economic futures. So for today's installment of our series, How We Changed, we go to Texas and Jenna Kelly Landis.
How did it change my life? It changed it by 180 degrees. You know, what happened was I ended up leaving my career path and opening a goat dairy and making cheese. In 2008, property values in our area plummeted. And so, you know, for the first time, my husband and I started to have serious conversations about what the future would look like in terms of real estate. You know, we had lived in our home in tiny little house in suburban Austin that was really reasonably priced, was really comfortable. But, you know, I was going to grad school. We knew that I was going to get a better job and I was going to be making more money. So maybe this was a good time to think about investing. Knowing nothing about real estate, we bought 15 acres and we just gambled. Towards the end of my graduate degree, I actually got a full-time job at a lobbying firm, working on behalf of public school districts throughout the state of Texas. And I was doing on paper what I had thought in my head was the dream job. The moment I actually started doing it, I had an epiphany that it was not at all what I really wanted to do, and instead it felt like a trap. Meanwhile, on the weekends, we had this land and we were coming out to the land and we had at that time purchased a really small tractor and we were just starting to cut into what was very overgrown, abandoned property. And I very quickly realized all I wanted to do was find a way to be able to quit a corporate sort of job and try to find something that we could do on the land so that I could not be in an office anymore. It's only truly, truly possible because my husband has an extremely secure, stable job where he has worked for, I believe, 15 years. And it's a company that is so conservative and steady that we trust no matter, almost no matter what happens with the economy, the job is going to be there.
We've got pictures of Jenna Kelly Landis and her goats on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. While you're there, take a second. Tell us how the financial crisis changed you. Would you? We're using the hashtag #HowWeChanged. Coming up.
Pepperoni does look great on camera, and it does look good in commercials, even if I guess you don't want pepperoni.
Trust me when I tell you, it looks better than sausage. I'm just going to leave that there. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1.5% today, 399 points. Closed at 25,709. The NASDAQ gained 1.1%, about 84 points, 74 and 21. The S&P 500 picked up 1.1%, 32 points, 27.79. There, Warren Buffett says he's not going to rule out buying an entire airline. I don't have to tell you what happens next, do I? JetBlue up just less than 2%. Delta flew up 2.3%. United Continental soared 2.5% today. January is the name of the month. January numbers for new home sales came out today. Not pretty. Higher mortgage rates plus shrinking tax breaks helped push down sales 7.8%. Builders shook it off because capitalism. Toll Brothers nailed a 2% gain today. Lennar built up 0.7%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's election day in Italy this coming Sunday, the third biggest economy in the European Union, if you're counting. So the result is going to carry some weight in the rest of the EU. But one of the key issues in that election is a distinctly domestic affair. What to do about the sizable chunk of Italian young adults, say 18 to 34-year-olds, who are still living with their parents? There is a bigger percentage of that cohort in Italy than in any other European country, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from Rome.
Bamboccioni is an insult. It means big babies. A politician first used the term here a few years ago to shut up pampered young people complaining about their lot. But at this protest against job insecurity in Rome last week, I met Matteo Frigerio. He works in airport administration and insists that many young Italian adults have to live with mum and dad.
The rent of the apartment are too high and we don't have the money. I'm living with my parents. I have 32 years and I cannot go outside of my home.
You are a bamboccione yourself.
In a certain way, yes.
65% of 18 to 34-year-old Italians still live in the family home, and many, like 21-year-old student Martina Antonini, say they have little choice.
I live with my parents. I study and I also work, but I can't afford to live alone because I have a really low wage.
Martina is desperate to fly the nest, and so is her older sister, a graduate.
Even my sister, she's 27 years old and she lives with us, but she also can't afford to live alone. She's just a waitress now. She has a master's degree in psychology.
Italy's scandalously high youth unemployment rate of 32% makes matters worse. The plight of the Bamboccioni has figured in the election campaign. But I've come here to the baroque splendour of the Palazzo Madama, seat of the Italian Senate, to speak to a politician who's not entirely sympathetic to the Bamboccioni, Senator Lucio Malan of the centre-right Forza Italia.
In some cases, it is because it is much better to be fed and housed and cuddled by their mothers than going to work.
We can tackle youth unemployment, he says, but
we cannot do anything for the over-cuddled young men and women.
That may sound heartless, but there's something in it, says Patrizio Nisirio of the Italian news agency ANSA.
A lot of people in Italy prefer to stay home because, you know, for some of them, independence is less desirable than mama cooking and ironing your clothes. And that's a fact.
And mama is more than happy to oblige.
She's happy for kids not to leave the nest.
That's not the case, though, with 21-year-old student Domiziana Domeniconi's mother.
She wants me to leave.
Oh, she does?
Yes. As soon as possible.
Domiziana aims to leave home as soon as she graduates and to leave Italy too, to live and work in France.
Because I have a lot of friends that live in Paris. At my age, they work and they have a home of their own. It's easier there, I think.
200,000 young Italians emigrate every year. A shocking flight of human capital, say the critics. A much bigger problem than the Bamboccioni. And the ultimate irony. In spite of its bambino-loving culture, the country is driving its young away. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Consider the humble pizza commercial. Hot melted cheese, perfectly done crust, and pepperoni. Virtually every single time, it's pepperoni you see in those ads. It's been that way for decades. Danielsa Pulvarez wrote about why at the website Eater. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
So you've done all this research. What are the three kinds of toppings we always, always, always see in pizza ads?
Well, pepperoni reigns supreme. And mushroom is the number one vegetable that we have on pizza. Sausage is the distant second protein, but really nothing touches pepperoni.
Okay, how come? Is that just because we're a pepperoni-loving people?
We apparently are. Based on the statistics, I looked up this delivery app, Slice, and it went state by state. Pepperoni was number one in most places.
Let's get to that strange world of food styling. One of the reasons I think you mentioned that pepperoni does so well is that it photographs really well.
Yes. This was actually when I was interviewing someone who's worked in advertising for more than 20 years. I said, you know, tell me, give me the rundown of why pepperoni all the time. And he said, you know, sometimes it is about what photographs well, because think about it. If you're going to photograph sausage, it might look like poop. And yeah, so, you know, he's right. Pepperoni does look great on camera and it does look good in commercials, even if I guess you don't want pepperoni. I mean, my mother is a perfect example of this. She will not eat pepperoni ever. It's not her choice of topping. But when she sees an ad for it, she will say, that looks so good.
That is too funny. Cultural ubiquity is a thing, too, right? The pizza emoji has pepperoni on it, which I didn't really think about until I read this piece.
Yeah, I didn't think about it either. Actually, I had to go look at it because I didn't realize it's just we do it without thinking. You know, it's become synonymous with pizza in general, whether or not that's the one that you order.
What's your go-to when you need a slice of pizza?
You know, pepperoni.
No, come on, seriously? Could you be more cliche?
I know I am. Well, actually, I will say one of the places that I interviewed for the piece, Sophia Pizza Shop, their co-owner, he makes a spinach dip pizza slice, so I'm kind of partial to that too.
Well, so, but that goes actually to a different question, not to get all serious and everything about pizza toppings, but if so much of the market is pepperoni and all the advertising is pepperoni, what about the, you know, more esoteric kinds of toppings? I guess you just have to seek those out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I ask, because especially with a smaller pizza shop like Sophia Pizza Shop that's just in New York, and their advertising is more that people are looking on Instagram, right. You know, it's not national commercials. And so I asked why they chose to do that, because they do have these grandma slices and vodka slices and baked ziti slices and all these different offerings that are kind of outside the box. And he said, I don't know, it photographs well and it gets people here, and then they see what else that we have.
Danielle Sepulveris, she writes in Eater most recently about all those pepperoni pizza ads we see out there. Danielle, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which millennials don't really come out looking so great. I saw this on CNBC, a survey by the financial services company Comet, here with one of the highlights. Of the single unmarried people aged 20 to 36 who were surveyed, 37% of them said they would end a serious relationship over a raise of $37,000. That's all it would take. Although, to be fair, it does kind of put lie to the whole millennials are lazy trope, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 1.5% today, about 399 points. NASDAQ gained 1.1%, 84 points. S&P 500 picked up 1.1% as well, 32 points there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects team includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.